Metaphysical Philosophy Podcast. I'm Toby Buckle. In this episode, I'll be discussing integralism with Kevin Vallier. Integralism is a movement on the political right, which, like me, you may have encountered in passing, but not really gone into depth on. And if you're interested in doing so, this is the episode for you. Kevin may also be familiar to you if you're a long-time listener. He's been on the podcast before and is a great communicator on a range of topics from liberalism to religion to the interface between those two things. And he's Associate Professor of Philosophy at Bowling Green State University. I'll just mention before we get started, I actually recorded this interview along with another one, which I'm going to be releasing at the same time, at the end of last year. So it's taken me a few months to release these, or anything for that matter. I've had a few different things going on, and I've been meaning to get these to you for a while. So apologies to Kevin for the delay there. But having listened to this back to do all the editing, this is a super interesting conversation where we explore not just the history and philosophy of integralism, but a related set of philosophical questions about what political movements and political belief systems are and how they see each other and understand each other and themselves. So I found this super interesting and I hope you do too. Okay. Without any further ado, let's just get straight to it. I think the conversation is fairly self-explanatory. We go through stuff as it comes up. So let's get into it. This is Integralism with Kevin Vallier. Okay, I am joined today by Professor Kevin Vallier. Kevin, thanks so much for coming back on the podcast.
Yes, it's great to be back. I think since the last time I was on, I've become much more familiar with the kind of work you're doing and the way you're sort of interfacing and the great conversation I've been part of for most of my career. So it's been fun to see.
Cool. Yeah, you've done a few of these since then, haven't you?
Well, I mean, your podcast, I mean, just watching what you're doing, I really like. So,
cool. No, I appreciate that. And you have just published, and I have just read, All the Kingdoms of the World, Religious Alternatives to Liberalism. Before we even get into the topic, what was like... No, let's just start with this. Kevin, what is integralism?
Yeah. So good. So just the background on the book was that, there's been a movement in the UK for a while that's called itself post-liberalism. But in the United States, that term is sometimes used to describe a kind of faction on the new right that has arisen since Trump's election. And many of the leaders of this faction are not what you would call Christian nationalists, because many of your listeners will have heard of that term, because that's mostly a Protestant thing. But in the United States, there's this movement called Catholic Integralism. They call themselves post-liberals, but now they include people like people may have heard of, like Patrick Deneen or Saurabh Amari, or perhaps Adrian Vermeule, a professor at Harvard Law School. When Oxford asked me to write this book, they kind of wanted me to do is look at this new phenomenon and to try to sort of engage the ideas and see what was going on. Because, the new right is a kind of smorgasbord of kind of very marginal ideological traditions that somehow have a bigger voice than they did before. And what I'm about to tell you about is the group that is in some ways the most intellectually sophisticated of those groups. We'll talk a little bit about why. For a while, though, and even to some extent now, this group calls themselves Catholic Integralists. And it is a kind of Roman Catholic 200 proof anti-liberalism. They want to uproot kind of the liberalism root branch and stem. So let me just say what I think liberalism is and what I think integralism is. So I take liberalism to be, and you'll have opinions on this, strong opinions on this as well, it's a series of social movements and theories that arise, you know, for reasonably long periods, but usually in response to some kind of gross restriction on freedom and equality. And so, you know, when I think of the liberal tradition broadly, including all its wings, I'm thinking of this series of movements and theories and ideologies as concerned with individual and group freedom, and that freedom can be, you know, negative or positive or Republican or what have you. Equality can be something, you know, thin, like equality before the law, equal opportunity, or it could get more extensive, substantive equality, freedom from domination in the workplace, or, you know, income redistribution or what have you. Then there's a kind of principle of toleration. You know, liberalism has been concerned, particularly with religious toleration, for a really, really long time. And then there are interesting questions about, you know, what does toleration involve? Does it require the privatization of religion or not, say, for instance? And then there's a kind of principle of mutual advantage, where the thought is that society can be structured so that kind of everyone can work together. It's not that we're inevitably divided, say, by class or race or gender or what have you. The thought is that there's reconciliation somewhere. So, you know, for classical liberals, or that is market liberals, that happens primarily in the market. For kind of left liberals, it happens primarily in democratic deliberation. And so when I think about the liberal tradition broadly, that's what I mean. It's some interpretation of the ideas of freedom, equality, toleration, and mutual advantage or harmony of interests or something like that.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And you said you might disagree, because I think we're proponents of reasonably distinct types of liberalism. But it's a family of things, right?
Yes, that's right.
You know, we can discuss, and we have discussed, which particular family branch on the family tree we prefer.
Right.
But it's a family of things, and within it, you know, you could say in a Wittgensteinian sense, there's certain resemblances, there's certain core themes that tend to come up again and again, vis-a-vis, as you say, freedom, equality, toleration, so on and so forth.
So we're on the same page about that. The important thing about the post-liberals, actually, one of the things that's important about it is they don't understand liberalism as a family resemblance concept. They understand it as having a kind of very coherent and substantive core that they attack relentlessly. And unfortunately, because of the diversity of the liberal tradition, their ratio of straw men to actual criticism is stunning. Almost to the point where I wonder if they're even trying to engage the liberal tradition at all. But so what are like the subgroups of this sort of post-liberal or anti-liberal movements? Well, I'm not going to tell you all of them. I'm just going to tell you about the one I focus on in the book. And it's pretty opposed to liberalism. So here are the three conditions that I think make for a Catholic integralist. The first two are ones that many, many theists around the world can accept. So the first one is that sort of God authorizes the state to promote the common good, the temporal common good, the earthly common good of its citizens. Now, actually, strictly speaking, on an integralist view, God can authorize the people to form a constitution and choose a president. It doesn't have to be monarchical, although in practice, I think most integralists, as strange as it sounds, are monarchists. But the point is that the state can be structured in different ways, but it has to be divinely authorized. That is, legitimacy does not come first and foremost from the people. It can come from the people, but only by way of God. So that's sort of principle one. And I think there are many democratic Christians who think, okay, God authorizes the people to choose their leaders. There are many Muslims who believe this as well. So the second one is even simpler in some ways. God authorizes the church to promote our eternal good. That is what lasts not just in this life, but in the next. And to sort of bring people into the church, the Great Commission, through attempts to sort of bring people to belief and practice. In Catholicism, this is relatively well defined because they have an extremely specific theory of how the church should be structured in terms of the Pope acting in concert with his bishops to enact and to clarify and to support matters of faith and morals. So those are the first two conditions. And these are things, again, that particularly Christians and Muslims, which comprise, I think, over half the world's population, can hold. It's the third condition that is really, really striking. So much of the medieval period when this view arose, There was widespread belief that God authorized these two powers or authorities. But instead of thinking they could just be functionally separate, to some extent at least, as we do, particularly moderns typically think, for them that wasn't even on their radar, for a variety of historical reasons. And so the question was, well, how should they work together? Right? Like, how should, what, which one is superior, which one isn't? What are the options? And so, you know, in some cases, at least particularly in the early Middle Ages, the thought is that the king had some kind of sacred power and could, say, appoint bishops. The Catholic Church fought against this for a long time and effectively laicized European kings, took all their religious authority away so that there could be what they called the liberty of the church. So the church had its own direct authority over its bishops and clerics, where they could be tried for certain crimes and so on. So the church was seen as this free institution whose end was nobler than that of the state, because it's concerned with eternal things and not just with temporal things. And so the thought is, okay, look, the church is the state superior. But what does that mean institutionally? What does that mean in terms of sovereignty? Well, it can't be the case that all political authority comes through the Pope. The Pope can't just say, overthrow a sultan or also take agricultural policy away from kings. But when the state's mission bears on the mission of the church, the spiritual mission, then the church has a kind of sovereignty over the state. So here's how that would work concretely. Suppose that the church excommunicates someone for heresy and gives them a certain time to repent. It was often a year. If they refuse to repent because heretics were seen as such a public threat and nuisance, they could call on Christian kings to impose civil punishments on the heretic, which by the time you reach the 13th century is burning them alive. And so the idea here is that the church has its own law, it's its own polity, and it can impose all kinds of penalties on people. And if people don't come around, then the state could, or the church can call on the state to serve as what was for centuries called its secular arm. Now, there are a variety of Catholic theologians, particularly in early modern and, you know, late medieval period, that came to call this doctrine the doctrine of the indirect power of the Pope. So the Pope would have sovereignty over kings in matters of faith. So in matters of how does the king teach theology? What do schools do? What's a legitimate book to discuss in public, and so on? Morals policies, right? Like what immoralities would be banned and so on. Okay, so that's the one that's like going to be pretty weird to your listeners, but I can sum it up now, which is that the church has indirect sovereignty over the state in spiritual affairs. So let me just repeat integralism pretty quickly then. It's three conditions. God authorizes the state to promote the temporal common good. God authorizes the church to promote the spiritual common good. And in spiritual affairs, the church has a kind of sovereignty over state policy. That's it.
What got you interested in this? Because I've followed this book being written on Twitter. You've posted various times for sort of thoughts, mm-hmm. resources, so on and so forth. I'm just reading a vibe here, which is like, is this, I have a category in my head of like intellectual dirty pleasures, which is things that like we don't agree with, but we're interested in, we can kind of see where the other person is coming from on some level. Does that sort of capture your relationship with this?
Yeah. There is a story. And the story actually is this one. When I was pretty young, my late teens, and I got to college at WashU in St. Louis, I immediately got involved in politics. This was interesting. I was actually working on the Al Gore campaign in the fall of 2000. But I also encountered a whole host of ideas I'd never heard before, particularly conservatism and libertarianism. And I actually found libertarianism quite attractive. And I started to read. I started to go to conferences and stuff like that. And I met a libertarian philosopher. If you know of him, you'll be stunned that he was ever a libertarian, Edward Fazer, who's a kind of major sort of Catholic apologist and Aquinas scholar. And he was very influential with me, but he abandoned libertarianism for a view like integralism. It wasn't called integralism then, because that was about 2004. And so he went from a rights-based theory of politics to a kind of good-first theory of politics. The thought was, look, what justifies the state is that it promotes the good, and of course there's an ultimate good, an internal good, and so probably this, you know, the state and the church should work together on that matter. And I was sort of gripped by this. I thought, well, you know, there's a certain kind of like weird coherence to the view. It's kind of like the act utilitarianism of Christianity, right? It's like, well, what should the state do? Like the good. Now, of course, you know, the both views are kind of very tightly coherent in that respect, but they both have terrible moral implications. But I found that as I got to know more and more people who hold this view, they're happy to accept the terrible moral implications for the sake of the coherence and supposed theological orthodoxy of the position. And so I got kind of fascinated. I thought, look, you know, I'm a Christian. You know, should I go over to a good base theory of politics? So why wouldn't I go over? And in graduate school, I developed, you know, a series of reasons about why I wouldn't. But of course, you know, I wanted to get my PhD without too much trouble. And I, you know, I wanted to get a tenure track job and I wanted to get tenure. And, you know, you never really know how people respond to working on really strange topics. I don't know if there was a huge amount like of discrimination, but it's like, why would I risk it when I'm interested in other stuff? And so after tenure, about 3 years ago, Oxford reaches out to me and says, hey, you know, we want to commission a book on this online movement. A friend of yours recommended you. This is Jacob Levy, who knew I'd been interested in it for some time. And I decided, you know, I wanted to write in political theology, particularly to create a kind of mode of inquiry that I like to call analytic political theology. And I was working on a number of essays on my positive view, but I thought, you know what, like, I'm no Rawls, but I think one of the coolest things that Rawls could have done is to actually like take utilitarianism on its own terms rather than what he thought utilitarianism was, and then to address it kind of from the inside. Like, it would have been great if there was just like a, okay, like, it's not just, oh, the separateness of persons or whatever, or we're going to interpolate utilitarianism as a choice behind the original position or whatever.
This is an aside, but one of my sort of bigger gripes with modern political philosophy is both Rawls and Nozak kind of begin by discarding utilitarianism and then just moving on without a huge amount of engagement with it.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes. And I'm frustrated with that too. So I thought, well, you know, if I'm going to try to do my own political theology, here's something that would be cool. Take a view that has a kind of weird, attractive coherence, like utilitarianism, and then try to state on its own terms why it's wrong. And so I've been gripped by this view for a long time. I've been thinking about it a long time at the purely kind of meta-ethical, ethical, and theological level. But I didn't know a lot about what we might call like kind of bells and whistles, like the sort of way they think about law, the sort of their history, how they think about economics and so on. But I thought, you know, look, if I want to do positive political theology, I better do some negative political theology first. So I threw myself into researching for the book, and also about 2 years in, I just discovered that many of my criticisms I thought would actually recur in other religious anti-liberal doctrines that have more influence. So like Chinese Confucian anti-liberalism and Sunni Islamic anti-liberalism. Sunni Islamic anti-liberalism is kind of like the premier anti-liberalism in terms of its actual political power. So I ended up writing against integralism, but also trying to explain what I thought was attractive about it. So I actually spent quite a while on trying to explain what's attractive about the doctrine to Catholics. And part of my reason for this is to steelman my opponent. But another part is I'm trying to kind of get like kind of normal Catholics to see kind of like, well what is happening? You know, like why, what's going on? And so I'm giving the best arguments for integralism in part because I'm trying to bring people in the conversation. And then I go into my critique, but it's important that the critique is entirely internal. I'm not coming to utilitarianism as a Kantian and saying, oh, respect for persons, you're done. In the same way, I'm not coming to integralism and saying, here, oh, freedom of religion, you're done.
Or more foundationally, atheism, scientific method, and it's just a wrap. You know, Yeah.
And so that's the book I decided to write. And that's the story of how I got there was, oh, wow, this is the view. This is like the radical alternative to kind of my what has increasingly become a kind of classical liberalism rather than any kind of I'm not a Nozickian. I haven't been for a long time. Between, you know, Locke and Aquinas, right? It was like, or at least the libertarian Locke. I have a much more complicated view about Locke now. But at the time, it was Locke or Aquinas. That was the alternatives. And I had to think, oh, man, like, these are both pretty coherent systems. But one of them has horrible moral implications in a way that the other one does not. Although I did come to believe that Lockean libertarianism does actually have a few horrifying implications. but again, that was my state of mind early on.
Can we just spend a minute on the relationship with liberalism?
Yeah.
So here's a thought. You mentioned Jacob Levy. I've heard him articulate this a few times, in that he said, and I've argued as well, we should be a bit careful of terms like illiberalism, which kind of by default assume that liberalism is the norm and anything else is an aberration. Right. Because in historic terms, liberalism is the aberration. And even in contemporary terms, we talk about liberal hegemony, and it's a bit of an overstatement, I think. What you might have is a liberal consensus, and even then, that's dubious at times. And also just, I'll do it for the left, because I'm more familiar with the groupings there. But if you think about, you know, radical socialism or some forms of, like, environmentalist movements or, like, social justice movements, like, say, radical feminism or something, it's not like their defining feature is that they're not liberal. Their defining feature is that they have goals and ideas and values of their own. Now, they might be willing to prioritize those goals and values and ideas over a sort of classical liberalism if the two conflict, but they're not, that their reason for existing isn't to oppose classical liberalism. They have their own things they want to achieve, you know. And I've always sort of bought that line of thinking and thought, yeah, that makes sense, you know. And now in the modern world, I see a lot of movements, and integralism, I don't know, you've spent way more time with it, but integralism is one of them, but actually an opposition to liberalism is part of what's defining of that movement.
It's part of what's driving them, even if what they say is different than what animates them. This is precisely the reason I called this view one of religious anti-liberalism, because it's religious, but it's chiefly anger in many cases. Now, there are some British integralists that were working on this in a different way about 10 years before, and that have been kind of not entirely happy with how things have gone over in the States with respect to the view. So, you know, the sort of philosopher and philosophical historian who's emeritus at King's College London now, Thomas Pink, was working on this stuff, you know, 20 years ago. But they were working on it chiefly as a way to kind of revive Catholicism, by getting Catholicism to sort of grapple with and accept its history. So they were anti-theological liberalism. Of course, they had problems with political and economic liberalism. But their goal wasn't so much to destroy the liberal tradition. So they had more of a positive program, but it wasn't actually political. It was, here's how the church should understand itself, here's what the church should do. But when the view started to migrate to the U.S., chiefly about 10 years ago, then it linked up with anti-liberalism in a really big way. And if you look at how the Americans in particular, Vernuel, Dineen, Amari, a host of other figures, they're attacking liberalism all the time, and they say almost nothing about their positive view. It seems what animates them is their anti-liberalism. I think they hide their positive view because they're worried that that will marginalize their influence. So I do think they have a positive view, but I also can just tell what gets them up in the morning. You know, it's pretty easy to see.
I know the figures you've just mentioned more through their tweets than their written work, I must admit.
Yep.
But it does seem to me as an
they're not
outsider,
that different.
Okay. Okay. It does seem to me like like you say, what gets them up in the morning is they seem very animated by a particular understanding of what they see as a hegemonic liberal order is.
Yeah.
And, you know, we could maybe spend a bit of time on just how differently they construct what liberalism is than, never even mind, like, what's its substantive content, just, like, what sort of thing is liberalism?
That's right. They
seem to have a pretty different idea than most liberals do, certainly.
Yes,
but, like,
yes.
Attacking that thing really, and, like, when you get right down to it, I had this exchange with Vermeule a while ago, and sort of when it comes down to it, like, what he's saying is, this is self-defense. You guys are coming after me first. And that's, like, my reason for doing this, is the liberal state is going to crush all sort of religious conservative dissent before it. And we have to, like, get the first punch in. essentially, but like almost like the pragmatic rationale for action was entirely about an understanding of what liberalism is and what it's going to do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the most interesting things about studying their writings is they don't actually tell you their social ontology of liberalism. Like, you don't actually, like, is this an ideology? Is it a movement? Is it some kind of, like, Hegelian type underlying zeitgeist or something? I mean, you don't really even know what kind of thing they're attacking. So I talk about this briefly in the chapter on Vermeule when it's transitional plans. It's something like an ideology and maybe like the Michael Friedan sense where it can have its own kind of life. It can have its own kind of causal effects. But the problem is that they model liberalism as a social force as basically omnipotent. So they never characterize what the opposition is. The closest you get in Dineen's new book or Vermeule's work is that there's like the folks, like there's like the masses, and they're not inherently liberal. And eventually they're going to rise up. If you get a sense of this being kind of right-wing crude Marxism, like crude right-wing Marxism, crude in terms of its Marxist, it's not very deep on Marx, but there is this sense that there's like the liberal elite and then there's like the folk, and the folk eventually will not tolerate liberalism anymore. So, you know, that's,
you know, the Marxist analogy, I'm just thinking out loud, the Marxist analogy doesn't actually strike me as crazy, as weird and like opposite ends of the traditional political spectrum as they might seem, because in the Friedan sense, you know, ideologies are kind of their own thing, a little bit above and beyond any individual's belief in them, shall we say.
Yeah.
But the way they talk sometimes, I think, goes a step beyond that, in that they talk about like the inevitable logic of liberalism.
Yes, that's right.
And that's further than Friedan would go. And it almost does remind me of, it almost does remind me of the way Marx, you know, it's a loose analogy, but Marxists might talk about the inevitable logic of capitalism. It's not just that capitalism can kind of be a social system that needs to be understood on its own terms, not just as a collection of persons.
Yeah.
It's that capitalism almost has a telos, it has an end point to it.
That's right.
That latter understanding of an ideology, be it Marxist or integralist, seems much less defensible than like a Friedan understanding to me. Like, or at the very least, there's a lot more work you have to do to justify that. And people, they Marxist or integralists, don't tend to do the work of I think you'd need to put some serious intellectual foundations on the table to say something like ideologies have inevitable logics or teleses, you know?
Yes.
And I don't see people doing that. I see them just assuming it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing of the Friedan analysis, and this is the point where people challenge him, is that he thinks of ideologies as much in the way you describe, but they only exist in combat with other ones. And again, this is, you might think, oh, look, for Friedan, you can't have total ideological hegemony. Like, it's not an ideology if every single person accepts it and there's nothing else attempted by it. We'll set that aside. But I do think it's important in any ideological analysis that before you say we've gotten to hegemony, that you have some conception of what the resisting forces are. And I think it's quite clear in the modern world, you know, and I think Friedan, this is ungodly Friedan, is that like liberalism, socialism, and conservatism are kind of coherent ideologies, and that, you know, can mix and match and war in lots of different ways. Fascism is not really on the table, although I think maybe in the last 10 years, maybe it's come back a little bit. And maybe the integralists have a little something to do with that, actually. Because of integralism's association with fascism in the 20th century. So you need to give some account of, well, why aren't there other things on the table? Or if there are other things on the table, why must they lose, right? And, you know, the story that Vermeule tells, and actually I think to some extent Dineen's new work is kind of Vermeule light on this stuff, which is that liberalism's internal logic is not that it's decadent and that people are, you know, hedonists in the crude, non-Millian sense of hedonists. just kind of wallowing around in pornography and drugs or whatever. The elite is actually extremely ascetic and focused, and they're very ideological, and they everything that they do, because they're secular, is political. That's all they care about is political victory. And they're just not going to be stopped. And if you look at how much of the elite institutions, particularly in Western Europe and the Anglophone world, you see that the liberal global elite has no real competitors. Now, the way they make that work is by lumping lots of different groups into liberalism. So they say, look, progressives are left liberals and American conservatives are right liberals. And so they have to make liberalism this great big tent in order to ascribe to make their thesis plausible, right? Because if like everyone who's powerful is a liberal, then it's a little easier to defend the hegemony thesis. But then their inclination to put everyone in the liberal big tent has a variety of problems. One, you lose your grip on what liberalism is. But second, you have to acknowledge that actually the liberal tradition isn't hegemonic. So if like, you know, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are part of the same social force, there's a lot of like internal conflict within liberalism. It doesn't seem to have, you know, an inevitable direction, because it could go in the market or the welfare state direction.
Yeah, I think that's the challenge of trying to. So, you know, as I think you know, I've argued reasonably strongly against the hegemony thesis, both from the left and the right, because there's people on the socialist left who want to argue something equivalent. I think the challenge.
There they call it the neoliberal consensus in many cases,
I think the challenge you have in making hegemony as even like a good description of the world is you have to articulate like some description of what liberalism is, even maybe just quite a broad family resemblance thing. And if you make it really in any way specific, you're going to be ruling out large sections of what actual powerful people actually believe, right?
Yes.
But then if you make
100%.
If you make it too broad, you're essentially really going to be describing nothing. Like, what are our common denominators, really?
Yeah.
You know, between, let's say, you know, the people who could conceivably win a general election in G20 countries. What are your common denominators? There's maybe some. But, like, whatever you get is going to be either a dishonest description of what's there or just incredibly banal, you know?
Yes, that's right. That's right. And also what you have to do is sort of attribute deep motives to people that even they themselves may not be aware of. So there's a little bit of like almost a false consciousness thing, like what they would really want if they really had power and they understood themselves would be X, Y, and Z. But then the problem comes, and over the last couple of weeks, particularly as I'm preparing for a debate with a British post-liberal, it's what I'm calling post-liberal clairvoyance. Like they can sort of see the future of liberalism in a way that and everyone else is sort of benighted, right? So like they have a special power. They understand what liberalism is under an underlying way, and everyone else just can't see it. I remember Vermeule even tweeted once, and this is hilarious. I mean, I just was so stunned by it. I screenshotted it, but he later deleted it, which is that sometimes I feel that only I understand the liberal mind, which is, you know, I mean, literally is a thing.
You know,
and I think a lot of these guys, I think they think precisely that. They think they've cracked the code. And this is one of the reasons they're so confident, is they think we get it. Like we're the ones who understand, and it's just us.
You know, where, and this is where the analogy with Marxism is, again, it's not crazy.
That's right.
Like, there are a lot of sort of socialist-y left. Because they're socialists, they have like a, you know, like religious people, a billion different factions, and we needn't get into all of that. But let's just say the strong socialist-y to Marxist-y left. Really, they spend as much of their time critiquing liberalism as they do conservatism, and not just like neoliberalism in their words, but you're sort of like suburban Hillary Clinton voting liberalism, you know. And they have, like integralists, a very strong understanding of what liberalism is, that's quite distinct from how liberalism understands itself. And they seem to talk sometimes as if they know what we believe better than we do.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's right. And they feel like they have that. Yeah, right. That we are benighted. Yeah. And that they are not. And it's very, very strange because these are people, given how much they care about politics, should know that they too are subject to bias and error. But of course, you know, it tends to be the liberal tradition that bangs on about how wrong we can be, how politically important that is. I think it is more common in socialist to conservative traditions to have a lot more confidence that you know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, it's the used to say of liberals, I can't remember, I actually think this is attributed to Robert Frost, but I don't know if it is actually his quote, I have to look it up, which is the liberal is someone who can't take his own side in an argument.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's not entirely true, but relative to the other traditions, it is.
I think
we don't exactly have an essence, right? But like we do have certain common features and inclinations, and even to some extent, like a kind of like almost like a shared culture, a shared intellectual culture that contrasts with what the other ideological traditions are doing. But not enough to make the post-liberal on left and right claims go through. I'm trying to grant them a little bit in my answer, but say, yeah, I mean, there's like. There is a doctrine of reason. There is a doctrine of like, you know, like that has to do with fallibility, that reasoning needs to be somehow nonetheless, you know, the basis of public discourse. So Friedan talks about this, about reason being kind of central to the liberal tradition and liberal politics. That's one of the I regard as a more it's one of the features that's like there's so much diversity in liberal views about reason. I don't necessarily include it on my short list. Even though, you know, if I had 10, I'd put it on there. So, like, there are these common values or threads, but the way that these other folks jam it all together into this, like, coherent movement where people have motives or not motives that are accessible to people, but they are accessible to outsiders, particularly small, very energetic groups of outsiders, it can't all hang together. There's too many things they want the concept to do at the same time. It just seems so implausible to me. But you know, when I speak to young people about integralism, I just had a guy email me from a prominent university and undergraduate saying, "Oh yeah, you know, there does, you know, he feels like there's this massive hegemony where he can't really trust anyone to like disclose his views on things, that he doesn't even know if he can trust his liberal friends at certain periods of time." I thought, you know, he was being, you know, a little dramatic. But there are people who seem really convicted by this. Like they seem genuinely terrified and enraged. So there's something else going on there than just like this intellectual project, because, and I think you see this on the left and the right, there's so much like emotional engagement. So when I read like integralists on liberalism, or I read books on neoliberalism from the left, like I'm reading one now, Triumph of Broken Promises, and it's just like, there's just like so much anger and resentment that's, I think, I feel like something more that's going on than like an intellectual error.
No, definitely. I mean, yeah. I think taken as a substantive view, the sort of teleological understanding of ideologies is insufficiently argued for, shall we say, yeah. Right? Just on the intellectual merits of the thing. I think there's two things going on with the process you're describing, and I'm purely talking from the left here, but they may very well also apply to, say, integralism. One is ideologies aren't just sets of beliefs, either moral or substantive. Yeah. They're also epistemic frameworks through which we interpret social and political reality.
Yes, they're concretizations of concepts. Yes, right.
Yeah. And they're sort of self-confirming in a way, in that you put on a particular pair of glasses, it will show you stuff you didn't see before, and then that will in itself sort of validate that set of glasses, not as one set of glasses amongst many, but as the correct set of glasses that shows you real social reality, whereas other sets of glasses distort it. And Marxism is quite overt about this. It talks about experience, it, you know, directly experiencing objective reality as opposed to false consciousness, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of ideologies do that. And I would say, in fact, that sort of believing that what the ideology has done is show you how things really are, whereas everyone else is misled, I would say, in fact, that's the norm. And liberalism perhaps has just evolved certain methods. I mean, liberalisms can be sort of doubt ourselves almost to a fault sometimes, but have guarded against that sort of like confirmation bias, essentially. Yeah. Whereas there's non-liberal groups on the left that really don't. And I think on the right that really don't.
Oh,
the other thing is, I think there's a lot of people, and again, I'm sort of talking from the left, but I see it on the right too, who have a very deep bone sense that there is something profoundly wrong with the world. That there is something not just like tax rates like could go up or down or something like that.
Right.
But there is something grotesque about the social and political ordering as it exists.
Yes, and absolutely.
The movements that come along who say, essentially, everyone through your entire life has kind of looked at you like you're overreacting for a bit, but you're right, and they're wrong, and here's why. Any movement that does that is going to be very, very attractive, and will find adherence. It might always be a minority thing, but it will find adherence.
This is especially true in the U.S., where the way this book connects with the previous book on trust and polarization is that there is the situation in the U.S. sort of declining trust and rising polarization that I think makes it a fertile ground for anti-liberalisms, because when you get lower trust and more polarization, particularly at the emotional level, it's much harder to see the humanity of your opponents, and you're much less likely to listen to them and take them seriously. And so you think their views have no merits, and so they must have terrible motives. So that's another thing that's a piece of this, is people get very certain of their own view, but they feel no tug towards the other view. And there is a kind of mass psychological story I've been trying to tell about that in the United States. And I also think there's evidence we're exporting our polarization to lots of other countries. And so I, you know, that's one reason that anti-liberalisms on left and right could very easily grow in other countries. And as I think, you know, to some extent they are. So, and also there's the religion angle to this that factors in more on the right than the left, which is particularly within Catholicism, because there's so this ancient, like pretty impressive intellectual tradition. I think the certainty is even easier to fall into, because you think, look, I both have dogma and philosophy, and they all kind of hang together. So if you read a lot of post-liberal stuff, that particularly in the UK, the less well-known sort of British integralists, they'll write whole books. They're just talking about theology like the whole time, and then they grind out the political conclusions like really fast. And I think they're just like so impressed with the intellectual lineage. I mean, if you can count yourself as having Aquinas in your tradition, that's, you know, whatever you think about Aquinas, like that's, he's an impressive guy, you know. And if you also have to where many of the greatest minds in, you know, perhaps, I mean, if you want to trace it back to Augustine, you can. But tracing it back to the 11th century is pretty plausible. And so, you know, if you're an integralist and you think you have really between the 11th century and the early 20th, our view was pretty common and defended by a whole variety of different people. It's also much easier to get, you know, really caught up in. There's also this old Catholic story about how certain ideas like medieval nominalism about universals, you know, that there aren't really real universals like kinds, but those are just ways of speaking about individuals, inevitably kind of leads to Protestantism and then to liberalism. And it's this kind of really, really implausible declinist narrative. But the sort of integralists have been able to integrate their story about American politics into this much broader narrative that many non-integralist Catholics accept, where they blame like the ills of modernity, the grotesqueness of modernity, on like the loss of the idea of human nature. And so that's an element in integralism that's like really, really interesting, and it's kind of hard to grasp.
Does that connect at all to like, there's this idea I've seen floating out in the ether that like modern social justice is essentially like Protestantism rediscovered. Like, there's certain instincts that have led people to be Protestant. And then with secularization, which happened in Europe, and to an extent is happening finally or eventually or whatever in the States, people who were in the past would have been a certain type of busybody Protestant do-gooder are now preaching intersectionality and privilege and all that, and it's kind of the same set of instincts, just without the theological superstructure. I'm not saying I buy that in any way, but
it's very common. Deneen's very explicit about this, for instance, that liberalism is a kind of post-Protestantism. The problem with this actually is the story about political elites in the U.S. is actually really interesting, because so many of them started off as unusually religious. I mean, even for like the early modern, late medieval period, you had these colonies being started by people who were intensely religious. And it's hard to tell a story about American elites without talking about matters of faith. You can sort of do it in some other countries where maybe say it was always not a big deal to them, but I think it's hard to do in the U.S. So there is a fervor that seems somewhat continuous, but I still see modern movement as a replacement of the sort of a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant elite that ruled the country in a certain way, a certain broad sense, as a reasonably broad tent for, you know, about 150 years. And their decline, I think, is still not very well understood. But they, I think of them as having sort of vacated the institutions, their own kind of weird cultural suicide that I think we still don't entirely understand, that allowed the new kind of secular progressive of all its strands to kind of become more dominant, particularly in the academy. And I think that's what people are kind of picking up on, that there's just like the academy's got this kind of like renewed strange set of ideas that seem to a lot of people ridiculous and poisonous.
Go ahead.
A lot of the post-liberals are ones who are moving through the academy. And because they're overexposed to what they regard as grotesque and crazy ideas. And so spread that out to the population at large, like as if like Biden is woke or something, which is ridiculous, right? If anything, Biden's been really good at disempowering the far left without, you know, he's just kind of muted them, given them nothing in terms of legislation. He's been completely successful as far as I can tell.
I think, you know, within a university context, you're getting, let's just call it social justice, not as a pejorative, but just as like a grouping of ideological forces. I think in a university humanity setting, you're probably getting like the strongest conceivable dose of that. And there's been a whole load of people who've essentially made careers on like attacking that. Which I think lands a lot less true once you get out into the sort of quote unquote real world. One thing I find interesting is the way the right has like continually created these like false genealogies for social justice concepts. So initially we had the idea that this was quote cultural Marxism, and it came from like the Frankfurt School of like Horkheimer and Adorno and stuff. And I actually wrote about those dudes from my MA for a bit. And I'm like, no, that like there's all sorts of stuff to be said against Adorno and whatever. And, you know, those guys have their, but that is just like a not, these are completely separate things, you know?
Right. Foucault's a much bigger figure for, I think, now with that social justice left than Marx. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
A lot of it's much more mundane as someone who spent time in lefty organizations. A lot of it comes from like therapy culture. A lot of it. Gaslighting is a great example of that. It's sort of a sort of
trauma.
Trauma.
My wife's a therapist. You just connected some dots for me in a big way. I hadn't understood the far left is sort of influenced by the practice of therapy. But now that you said that, I'm very impressed by that analogy.
Okay. Yeah. Institutional practice, like for 50 years now, organizations have been doing like diversity seminars, right? At first, really just legal compliance. Let's not get sued by new civil rights laws. And over time, they've evolved. There's a sort of a number of different strains there, but they've evolved a more sort of substantive normative component to them. And it's just kind of like the language that they've picked up along the way. And then there's a number of like radical academic writers who've contributed particular terms like intersectionality and so on. And then those terms kind of take on a life of their own, a bit above and beyond whatever, more than what they were originally intended to do. But it's kind of a mishmash of a few fairly mundane things.
That's plausible.
But the right really wants it to either be somehow the latest evolution of Marxism or the latest evolution of like Protestantism. And one, those two origins are not compatible. But two, it's not really either. It's kind of much less dramatic than that, I would say.
Yes. No, I think that makes a ton of sense. In fact, allow me to make a slight joke about the left. I mean, there's all this stuff about people on the left being pretty miserable and like depressed and unwell. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, if that's true, I'm not saying it is, but like they'll be overexposed to therapists relative to most people.
Yeah.
So I mean, maybe they're just drawing it in because they're in therapy a lot.
Also, the section of the population for whom seeing a therapist is most normalized and stroke or least stigmatized.
Good call. Yes, absolutely.
Like, I'm sort of spitballing this, but my guess would be there's perhaps more of a stigma around seeing a therapist for people in older generations, people who are more culturally conservative, people who are rural as opposed to maybe, right? I don't know, but maybe.
Yeah.
There's definitely an argument to be made that, like, people, I don't know, my age and younger, say, who live in big cities and went to university are the most likely to see therapists.
Right. Well, they had them for free for a while. Yeah. For a few years in many cases. Yeah.
Which would mean that sort of language and sets of concepts has filtered into their political ideology.
That's really cool.
There's really an interest. I don't know. We're kind of just spitballing this one, but there's a paper to be written somewhere there, isn't there?
Yes. Yes. No, someone needs to do that because the thing with integralism is it's as untherapeutic as possible. So, it's here's what's true, here's what's false. Like, I always, when I talk about illiberalism, I often use analogy for my wife. It's like you bring in a couple, and the couple's like, we're having this fight. Tell us who's right, right? And the therapist never, ever does that, right? I mean, the therapist is even clinically bound to some extent with ethics to not do that because the goal is to preserve the relationship. And the relationship is usually more important than the issue. That's another therapyism. But the idea, that you just sort of – but with integralism, it's very clear. It's like, look, we know the truth, and the truth should reign, right? And so and there's also a sort of level of fist pounding. There's also a kind of masculinism. I was talking to Richard Reeves about this before he started his own Institute for Men and Boys. He's the kind of center left fellow who's been doing a lot of work trying to convince the left to sort of take boys and men more seriously as their own oppressed group. Not at the elite level necessarily, but like at the popular level. And we've also identified in anti-liberalism kind of many variants of kind of extreme masculinism of some kind that I think is very anti-therapeutic in the sense of like being emotionally vulnerable, being emotionally open, putting women and men on the same footing.
I wouldn't feel confident saying it with integralism, but the modern right is very, very, very hostile to all of that, essentially, as far as I can tell.
And you could see lately, actually, I've been doing some things on just like attacking going to therapy in particular. Mm. And I mean, as someone that's been kind of indirectly associated with like the mental health community, it's very, very destructive. Yeah. So I think what we I would want to say a little bit to try to maybe explain to your listeners about like, well, why is anybody fooling with these ideas?
Yeah, go for it.
And so one thing I said is that it's got a kind of coherence, right? It's like the state should care about the ultimate good. And so this is just one of the chapters in the book working that out, like really clearly saying, like, look, integralism is attractive because it has a kind of symmetric approach to the good. It's not just interested in like temporal goods or temporal social goods even, but sort of eternal goods. And they oftentimes make those rather social. So, you know, like, you know, the eternal goods, corporate union in Christ. So it's not just the individual being saved, it's the community as a whole being saved. And that's attractive if you think there are such goods, right? I mean, if you think they're eternal goods, it makes sense that maybe the state should be concerned with them, if it's any good at it. So that was one of my claims. And the other one I've also foreshadowed, which is that integralists take themselves to have a really powerful, influential intellectual lineage. And they're not completely wrong about that, because in medieval and early modern Europe, and even modern Europe, I mean, the amount of people who think if the Pope has a lot of power, things are going to go well or better is not small, like it is today. And so they actually can draw on a variety of figures who are explicitly defending integralism, but they were defending it in, say, the 17th century or even the 19th century. And so those are kind of like the two main cases for the view. It's like, look, we have this connection to the tradition, and we want the state to be concerned with the whole human good. Those I call the history of symmetry argument. So I think getting the appeal of the view intellectually is not so hard, because we've been talking a lot about the psychological draw, and I think that's as much a part of the story as the intellectual. But you can actually get a bit of an intellectual case going from this idea that the state should promote. And I think religious anti-liberalism have this in general. They have this thing like, we're the ones who take the religion seriously. We're the ones who are going to believe the religion, even if it doesn't turn out to validate our modern pieties. Which is to say that it comes out authoritarian. We care about all of the human person's life, not just the kind of finite part, but the infinite part. You know, you see this in Islam, in the kind of various strains of Islamism, for instance. It can be from moderate democratic, like you see in Tunisia, for instance, in many cases, ranging all the way, say, to the kind of the Wahhabists that the Saudi monarchy is in this kind of bizarre ongoing alliance with, that are in some ways the most kind of extreme and anti-democratic, because the range of Islamism is huge. So you see that in Islam. It's also, I think, something that is pretty interesting in the new area I'm studying and didn't get to write on, which is Hindu nationalism. If we get into that, it would derail us, because it's so fascinating and different in some ways than the others. But yeah, and you can also see this, I think, to some extent with Confucians, although when I started writing the book before she had engaged in a lot of crackdowns and really pushing his kind of warmed over Marxism, that I thought it was going to have more, Confucian version would have more influence. But all the same, you know, the thought is that these two claims, we take the religion seriously and we're concerned with the whole human good, like that's the intellectual story that these groups, particularly especially the religious groups, can sort of tell themselves, and that I actually think are pretty intellectually interesting in their own right. And then, so that's, I think, in many cases, the intellectual story. I think we've made some progress on the psychological story, but that intellectual part of the story should be brought in as well.
Okay, so question stroke comment before we go to, like, what's the answer from within Catholicism. Thought I have always had on this, I'll put it this way. So you in your book talk about how the sort of leading lights of integralism, Vermeule is a good example here, have generally worked to try and not be critical of the new Pope, Francis.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, that I actually generally don't see among sort of religious conservatives generally.
That's right.
This is one of my reasons why there's a variety of reasons, shall we say, why I don't buy this as a political position. But this would actually be one of them. And I would say it's almost directly analogous to, as you very well know, there's a line of critique people run against liberalism of, oh, you say you're so tolerant and you want a diversity of opinions and an open conversation, and yet the minute someone's an inch to your right, you'll shut them down, right? Stanley Fish has been running that argument for forever, and people, Deneen even has picked it up since then, right? Yeah. You don't really believe what you're saying, and I can tell you don't because you don't act it. That's a line people have run on liberalism forever, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you can run the same line on modern religious conservatism in that the minute the Pope says something, the minute the Pope rhetorically moderates on something that's important to the right-wing culture war, not even substantively moderates, rhetorically moderates, you know, the Pope's not suddenly changing the Catholic position on abortion or whatever. He's just saying, I'm not leading with that, you know? The other one would be, you know, which I'm a bit more familiar with, the Church of England in the UK, which is maybe not quite as, like, doctrinaire as the Catholics, but is by no means a raging socialist institution either, right? Will occasionally say something fairly bland and rooted in Christian history, like, maybe we should be nice to refugees, right? You will get this incredible backlash from people who consider themselves traditionalist, nationalist Christians. And so my, you know, if you're, like, position is premised on a respect for these institutions and the types of authority that they are imagined to have, then do you not need to actually respect these institutions and listen to them? And the minute they say something you don't like, you're accusing the bloody Archbishop of Canterbury of being woke or the Pope of being woke. And it seems bizarre to me that, it, you know, we're kind of divvying everything up in the culture war in terms of which side identifies with it. It's bizarre that we got the Pope. Like, that seems really wild to me.
Part of the origin story of integralism is that there are a lot of younger traditionalists that had precisely that issue with other traditionalists, was that, like, they said they were traditionalists, but they always had a problem with whoever was in power. And they were always looked like they were, like, tempted to schism, which for, you know, Catholicism is like, that's, you definitely don't do that. And so it developed as a kind of small internal culture among integralists, particularly the Americans. You never criticize the hierarchy. The British actually will be pretty careful, but they're very keen on criticizing Francis. This is one reason the two groups are partly estranged from one another, is that the Americans don't want to criticize Francis, in part because they are trying to practice what they preach, although there's also a very good strategic reason that they do this, which is that almost 100 years ago today, Pope Pius XI condemned the French integralist movement Action Française, which was led by an atheist anti-Semite, Charles Maurras, but was at least ostensibly integralist. And after that, it, you know, lost a great deal of influence. In fact, one of its major theologians, Jacques Maritain, who's like one of the most important Catholic philosophers of the 20th century and one of them, you know, he left the movement then and had to explain, like, why he did. And I think these integralists are confident enough they're going to be influential that they don't want to get condemned. And so the best way to not get condemned is to never criticize Francis's appointees, which they never do. And they dissociate from any Catholics that do that. In many cases, because their main place of discussion is Twitter, they will block those people. They'll just totally shut them out. So I think they have reasons of piety. I think they genuinely think that Catholics with their kind of inclinations are impious. But I also think there's this, like, really interesting strategic reason that people from the outside would just never know, which is that they're keenly aware of where other integralist movements went wrong, like associating themselves with a particular dictator, except that they're doing this with Orban. But I think they think it's going to work with Orban because he did actually seemingly legit win his last election. So it's not – he's not Mussolini. He's not Franco. Not yet, anyway. So there is that other strategic consideration, I think, to look at. And I mean, what's weird about this, and this is just sort of get into some of the criticisms, is that this led to a general feature of theirs that they don't talk about their positive view very much at all, the Americans. And so one of the difficulties in the book is I'm using a lot of the, particularly in chapter four, I'm talking about Vermeule's strategic works. So he converted to Catholicism in 2016. And so he's left all these strategic works in little places on the internet, which is like, well, how would a small sectarian group actually win? And what people don't know about Vermeule in many cases is that he's not just a law professor, but he's a kind of theorist of the modern administrative state. And so he has models, pretty sophisticated ones, about how the state operates, what its incentives are, how it responds, and so on. And so he's devised a kind of transition plan that's pretty wild. I even called it almost, like, personally, like, almost Thanosian, in terms of it's like a combination of, like, bad and absurd. in terms of the ultimate goal. But one of the things, yeah, a lot of Americans are thinking is, I think they really do believe they have a shot at winning. And so if you look at Deneen's book, what's it called, the new one? Regime Change.
Regime Change, yeah.
Right? So this is really what they're imagining. And so they're trying to sort of spin out, well, like, how would this work? And so Deneen's theory is actually kind of a Vermeule light. And so if you want to understand, I think, what's behind the Deneen, you should read the chapter, even if you don't read any other chapter, reading chapter 4 on Vermeule strategic writings, I think, is very revealing. And Deneen wrote an article for First Things in 2020, around the same time Vermeule reviewed Deneen's Why Liberalism Failed, where they're talking a lot about elite replacement theory. They're talking a lot about elite theory, right? And so, you know, one of the things I'm doing to criticize them, and this connects with everything we've been talking about, is that their theory of ideology and social change and so on is so wrong and confused that their theory of transition is basically either going to fail at, certainly, or it's going to be, to not put it lightly, a bloodbath, as it has been every other time. You know, if you look at any extreme ideological movement to co-opt the modern state when most people don't agree. So fascist communists and kind of the Iranian revolutionaries, there's pretty clear common threads of things that they need to succeed and that a Catholic can't accept.
You know what's so interesting about this conversation is, like, I'm so much more familiar with the far left than the far right. Like, it's just where I've spent a lot of my time and I know a lot of these people, right? The arguments are so almost directly parallel in that one of the big arguments that I would run against revolutionary socialism, not like the sort of Bernie Sanders, let's expand the welfare state socialism, but
just
like
FDR.
But like the people who genuinely and unironically talk about a revolution, not as Bernie Sanders, I think, means as like a shift in policy, but like no, an actual revolution. One of the arguments I run against that is your descriptive account of how things do work is so wildly flawed that it's difficult to see how any strategy premised upon that would not also be wildly flawed.
Yes, yes,
and that sounds like the exact account that you're running.
Yes, that's the idea, is that there's a clear plan, and that often happens on the left and the right, or say among Islamists or other groups that are trying to co-opt states that they think are corrupt. And so the story usually goes like this. Like, first you have to have like a consciousness raising sect, right? Like you have to get a bunch of people together, hundreds, thousands of people that kind of see the truth, right? And then you've got to start getting these folks in positions of power while history does your dirty work.
Right.
As late capitalism is doing your dirty work. So you can just wait for the collapse. You don't actually have to hurt anybody, right? You just got to get your people in the right places at the right time. And Vermeule's been very clear about, like, well, how do we get people in, you know, in the administrative state? How do we get judges? He never talks about winning elections because I think it's pretty obviously they're not going to win elections in a mostly Protestant country. But if they can control the elites, then they think they can win. And then, so the steps are like, you form the consciousness raising groups, you put them in positions of power, you wait for liberalism or whatever, capitalism or whatever, to collapse, and then you move in. Right. And Vermeule's got little pieces talking about these different things. And so the way I assembled them is like, there's really only one way to assemble them, because that's every small sect's plan, right? Like, you know, that was like, it's not unlike the neoconservatives in the U.S. trying, although they weren't trying for a total revolution, they just wanted lots of wars. And so that's one reason I think they were successful in a way that Interrealists will never be, because they were just like, hey, let's attack all of these countries.
Well, on the positive side, like, you know, the expanded role of the federal government in creating, you know, welfare states and social security and whatever, right? I mean, I see that as a positive. That there was an element of elite capture to that.
Yes.
But they weren't aiming at the total destruction of the system. They were aiming at like implementing a particular agenda.
Social security. Right. Just US having a pension system as Germany had had for public pension system as Germany has had for 40 years before the US did.
Reaganite, Thatcherite thing, like the libertarian, like von Hayek and so on, is self-consciously an element of elite capture. to that.
Yes, yes. No, on Socialism and the Intellectuals, he's quite clear. He's quite clear about that. Although, you know, Hayek was much less focused on party politics, and the stuff he says about party politics is pretty crude and ranging into like his bravest intellectual oversights, like with respect to the Pinochet situation. Nonetheless, sorry to read, because I'm
yeah,
reflexive knee jerk. I like Hayek and I feel bad about his being so bad on these issues. Embarrassed really, but nonetheless, it is there. And so I think when I say, look, Vermeule has an elite capture theory, I mean, I've not seen any integralists say in response to the book, like, no, he misreads what's going on. There's just total silence with regard to it because, frankly, I think I got it right. So people can't really say that I misrepresented him. But, you know, but it's also important, I think, to not just look at, like, the nuts and bolts there, but, like, to try to address, like, the romantic aspects of these views. Like, what are people hoping for? What are they aspiring to? They want to destroy the left. Like, we've talked about that part. But, like, some of them kind of do like to imagine, like, what would it be like once they're all gone? You know, what would we be able to do? What's extraordinary what we're able to do? And they think they want to create a kind of uniquely just order. They love to talk about the concept of order, 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 order. Post-liberal order is the name of one of their substacks. And their thought is like you can have a society that's organized. It's not a modus vivendi. Most anti-liberals actually hate the idea that their ideal would be a pure balance of power. This is especially prominent in the Confucian tradition, but it's also true in the Catholic tradition. They want people to grasp true virtue. They want people to grasp sort of the moral law. And they want people to be kind of cultivated and trained so that they can grasp the moral truth and act from it. And in the case of Catholicism versus Confucianism, there's a great focus on cultivating virtue in the pursuit of the afterlife and in terms of ultimate salvation. And this is one of the reasons that Catholic anti-liberalism is, in a certain sense, less desperate or more desperate and panicky than Confucian anti-liberalism is. I think once you recognize that what they're imagining is this kind of almost like weird kind of like the best analogy. I mean, it really is this kind of like medieval view of like there being a natural order and a kind of natural balance that keeps society from getting too corrupt and unstable.
Very, very directly that there is this is by no means unique to integralism, that there is an extra human origin to the social order that is to some sense knowable and predictable. And we have strayed from it to our detriment.
That's right. And this gets the most articulated and extreme in terms of politics when you get into the radical Islamists, not the – I focus on the moderates.
Which is – sorry, if I could say one thing about that, which is what distinguishes it from – because my listeners are overwhelmingly on the left. I can imagine a bunch of people saying, you've just said that socialism is the same as integralism. No, I said there's similarities in terms of how the argument progresses. But that's the difference. Socialists don't imagine a top-down order from which we have fallen.
No.
They want to radically reimagine a new world. So there is a difference.
Yes.
They are the futurist ideology, you know.
Yes.
I'm not saying they're the same thing, and that bit that you just mapped out is the bit that's not
that's
the
what's
same.
Really, really, really distinct is because there is this widespread belief in a natural order, a natural hierarchy, and that, you know, people's lives are going to be better if they go along with what's sort of natural and divinely established.
Yes.
Vermeule has been able to be more influential by saying, well, we're not going to get rid of the modern state. And so all this kind of Tolkien medievalist integralism is just a non-starter. Now, his view is also a non-starter, but I mean, it's at least saying we're not – he's even had some writings about this. Like, he'll even attack Tolkien. I mean, just trying to get like Catholics to move on culturally from the traditionalist kind of anti-statism and the kind of feudalism that they tend to like, to saying, no, we have to capture the modern administrative state because for military and technological reasons, it's going to stick around. What he's imagining actually is a little bit closer to, I think, what the modern left is imagining, which is that, like, the ideology of the state will collapse even if the state does not collapse. Yes. So that the empty, the vacated state can be colonized by the new group, right? Yes. So, like, it's not the modern state's going to die. Capitalist ideology will die, and then the state can be turned to help the workers. Similarly, on Vermeule's view, it's not that the state is going to die. It's that liberalism is going to die, and then the state can be recolonized. And so I think that's one reason that he's been able to be more influential, because he's promising his adherents not that they'll be able to smoke a pipe in their makeshift hobbit hole, but rather that they're going to be able to actually rule.
Yes.
This has been one of the importance of bringing in, you know, reactionary and, you know, sort of Nazi figures like Carl Schmitt, although Vermeule likes his pre-Nazi stuff, is to sort of say, look, you know, like, there's this, like, sense of which you should dare to command. I mean, the progressives rule, you know, they're happy to rule. The Chinese are happy to rule, and Catholics should be happy to rule as well. And so one of the things I think is important about critiquing integralism, even the ideal, is that to some extent you're imagining a modern order that's supposed to be given these medieval features. And so it's supposed to be this interesting kind of synthesis. Now, some of the integralists have kind of gotten on to me about this, like, no, we're anti-state. To which my response is, well, you know, I mean, you can call monarchs not states if you want to, but, like, come on. I mean, this is a semantic thing. But the statist integralists have been a lot more influential, precisely because they can say stuff like, well, here's what the state should do. Like, it should ban all pornography. Or, you know, a Republican president should ban all abortion at every stage by executive order. This is one of their views. They should make birth free, which is actually fairly popular. So sometimes they'll say popular stuff, and sometimes they'll say, like, really extremely unpopular stuff. So there is this medievalist sort of natural order sense, but there's also, and this is what I think makes them a little bit more influential, is they're just taking the modern state on its own terms, but they're doing weird stuff, like claiming the New Deal was Catholic and stuff like that. So that's, I think, was really important to sort of try to imagine, like, even if they got everything they wanted, could they hold on to it? And so, you know, I've got a whole argument that they can't do that. And then I also try to show that their ideology is morally incoherent. Right?
Okay, like that's what I wanted to close on. So we've discussed one set of arguments against this is its manifest on infeasibility, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Now, for me, like, in a sense, it doesn't really matter, because for me, like, you know, I'm not a Catholic. I'm not a Christian even. I don't think there's a natural order that we need to be brought into conformity with. And so the fact that it's completely unfeasible is just sort of like the cherry on the top for me. Like, okay, yeah, sure, there's that as well, but I don't want to do the thing to begin with. What's the argument from within Catholicism? Because, like, I suspect most Catholics would not buy a vision this extreme. And,
no.
You know, what's the argument from within?
It's mainly...
Say you could do it.
Yeah.
Say, why should you nonetheless refrain?
Yeah. This is a pretty fascinating and complex thing for the uninitiated. But basically, in the latter half of the 20th century, there are many reasons that the Catholic Church's hierarchy was trying to sort of accommodate liberal order. They didn't see it as much of a threat as they do now. They wanted to be part of the post-war reconstruction of Europe. They wanted to be able to protect Catholics who were popping up in the global South by sort of saying, look, we're not going to overthrow liberal order in favor of a confessional state. We're not even going to support that. And also, you know, a variety of Catholic theologians were just coming to accept that the liberal tradition had certain insights. And so they published this document at the end of the Second Vatican Council, Dignitatis Humanae, which is the Church's Declaration of Religious Freedom, which basically, for your listeners, like, pretty much just agrees with liberalism about religious freedom, with the exception of liking some kinds of mild establishment. So, you know, but I mean, you see this in, like, Italy, like, you, it doesn't really have much of an effect, but some people can like it. Like, you put up, you know, crucifixes in, you know, schools or something. Yeah. Like, or like the government funds sectarian schools in Germany, but you can get a tax exemption from it or whatever. Yeah. So they support, like, mild establishment, but they're very clear, like, the human person has a right to religious freedom, that it's universal, that it should be constitutionalized. This is based on the dignity of the person as made in God's image. This includes, like, really strong freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, freedom of educating your children, starting schools, starting churches, ordaining your own priests. I mean, it's dramatic. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge shift. And so one of the things the New Integrals have had to do is to reinterpret that document in a way that I think is like creative but not plausible. And so it has remained an extreme minority position. So that's it's that document that's kind of been the bone in their throat in terms of getting their intellectual progress off the ground. So they follow this reinterpretation, and it has this weird consequence, which is that the document is only talking about the relationship between the state and the individual. Mm. It's not talking about the relationship between the church and the individual. And so it's not speaking to how the church can authorize the state to back its policies. Mm. And this is kind of complicated and subtle point, but basically what ends up happening is dignitatis humanae in a Catholic state would not apply to Catholics, but it would apply to the unbaptized. So what they're saying is you can't force anyone into the religion, but you can force them to stay, which again is not unlike radical Islamism, which is you can't be forced to become Muslim. But if you leave the faith, it's apostasy. And in Islam, it's regarded more like as treason than it is. So again, I'm trying to be clear, like there's a billion Muslims. OK, so like this is not, you know, hegemonic. But if you read like Sayyid Qutb, you know, who's kind of one of the inspirations for ISIS or what have you, then it's quite clear.
But apostasy laws are enforced in a lot of countries.
Yes.
It's not a straw man.
No, it's not. And so what I try to do is say, well, look, the Catholic Church has said, look, the dignity of the person grounds religious liberty, whether you're baptized or not. And the argument is just that why would baptism, even if we grant everything the Catholic Church teaches about baptism, become a kind of what I call a moral transformer? Like, why would it transition or transform religious coercion on the unbaptized, which is always unjust, to religious coercion of the baptized, which is in many cases just? So here's one of my cases, which is actually a real world case, disturbingly enough. You're a Jewish family. You live in an integralist or papally controlled state, and you have a Catholic nanny. Your infant, let's call him Edgardo Motara, because this is actually the name of the infant. Their Catholic nanny sees that he's going to die, does a secret baptism of him, which is an emergency consideration, is considered licit by the Catholic Church. The Pope learns of the baptism, says the child has a right to a Catholic education. His Jewish family won't give it to him. So we're going to take the child away. It's like child protective services for religions. Like, we're going to take the child away and we're going to make sure he's raised Catholic. When this happened in the middle of the 19th century, Pope Pius IX raised little Edgardo Motara as his own, which is pretty weird. And it was an international incident. It was like a huge deal when this happened. I encourage anyone just to look at the Motara incident, just to Google that, like Edgardo Motara, and you will see this like wild case. It was the Elian Gonzalez of the 19th century. So I use a real world case, but also just as a general point, which is like, okay, look, like if baptism is basically like sufficient cause to say, oh, look, person's, you know, got all these new rights and duties in politics, then it has all these absurd consequences. There are things that you could never do ever to a Jewish child before baptism. But if someone like a Catholic nanny does an emergency baptism on them, that completely changes whether they have any religious freedom. And so I just try to go through, well, what are ways to square that circle? And I consider a bunch of options, and I just don't think any of them work. So, you know, the more consistent position would just be to either oppose religious coercion throughout or to embrace it throughout. But the integralists are in a funny position because they have to deal with the modern church's teaching on religious freedom, which creates this tension. So anyway, I think, you know, that's one of the arguments that they've got inconsistent moral commitments. Total religious freedom for the unbaptized, much more religious coercion for the baptized. I also think, as I argue in the book, this is actually a problem within Sunni Islamic political thought as well. And that both sides have had to deal with and work out because they sense that the tension is there. But as far as the vast majority of modern Catholics are concerned, the tension's resolved. Right, it's religious liberty all the way through.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and it does, the issue I sort of pointed out at the beginning is it does seem to set you up on a conflict with both the teaching of the church, the leadership of the church, and what the vast majority of believers believe.
That's right.
And Interlism is trying to do some intellectually clever things to get out of that. But yes, like, intellectual cleverness aside, the tension is still there.
Yes, and the biggest problem that they have, actually, is that even if they have a little bit of influence in American politics, like Dineen posts on his Twitter a picture with him and Senator J.D. Vance having a good time, they've got to convince the church. And it's a global institution. It's slow-moving. It has 5,600 bishops from which cardinals are chosen. The cardinals will have to elect an integralist pope. The pope will has to decide, for instance, that integralism is the way to go. An integralist pope might say, no, like, we can't go there. It's off the table. And then they've got to capture a modern state and establish a new relationship between the church and the state. And so what I say is just like, they've not done anything on the church side that has gotten them any influence. In fact, Francis has even said in a private audience that integralism is a plague. because he's Argentinian, so he associates it with fascism, and for good reason, because a lot of the integralists in the middle of the 20th century were Francoists or Salazarians. So anyway, they've got hundreds of years of work to do, and I think they understand that in a way, but given how quick modern social change is, like, you know, this is basically to give up the game in a certain way. But anyway, so I mean, those are the criticisms. There's like these, you can't get there, right? Transitional stuff. You can't stay there, the stability stuff. And, you know, it's unfair. Like, it treats certain people as subject to violence that it doesn't apply to others. So that's really where the critique comes in. But they're all internal critiques. So you don't come in blasting away liberal with your liberal guns blazing. You try to meet these young post-liberal minds where they're at, so to speak, and then to give them those arguments after taking them pretty seriously. And I think it's like really important because I think the liberal tradition's been really good at engaging socialism on its own terms at various times. I think it's been weaker in engaging various forms of conservatism, and particularly religious conservatism from within on their own terms, because I think one weakness of the liberal tradition is it because they've been so rightly concerned from the get-go about fanaticism, they've tended to sort of not take the persistence of religiosity very seriously, thinking that liberalism or religion can kind of be privatized or that people will secularize. And there's oftentimes a kind of contentment about that. And that leaves liberals kind of horrified whenever it sort of springs back into view. And so I think that that is something the liberal tradition really needs to correct. And there need to be liberals who learn to speak theologically. And there are from time to time. But it's been a weakness of the tradition, in my opinion.
This is a whole other conversation. We've got a hard stop coming. I think that is and has changed a bit over the past decade, even with... Uh-huh. There's a whole narrative I could go into about we had this sort of new atheist movement, and then that just sort of collapsed into another form of online reactionary anti-social justice type thing. But then I think you've also seen a number of voices come up within religion preaching a sort of – you've had much more overt and public sort of attacks on, for instance, literalist readings of scripture, but from within religion, I think. Anyway, that's a whole other conversation.
I just wanted to end where I thought, like, I'm trying to add value to the liberal tradition by just trying to say, okay, like, let's get inside this theology. And I think, you know, for many liberal readers, I've tried to structure the book so that you can kind of skip around, you know, if it gets into the weeds on certain theological issues, I think it will acquaint you kind of with the structure of religious anti-liberal views. And, you know, if you focus more on the kind of bookends of the book, so to speak, like the introduction, the first chapter, chapter 7, and then the epilogue, I think you could still get a great deal out of the book. And I think acquainting yourself with the Catholic version is very valuable. But at the very least, I've written it for liberals in part so they can sort of get a sense for how these views really function and what gets people out of the bed in the morning for these views.
Yeah. I'd also say, as a recommendation of the book, like, you might just be interested but not have a devastating amount of time to pursue this thing, which exists at the moment in like a billion message boards and online debates and so on. You might just sort of have heard of integralism and want to have a quick primer to sort of get up to speed with it, and a resource for that, and I don't know, but I don't think has existed before. And this book would definitely do that for you. Just like, here is what the thing is, you know?
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. That's important. And I think, you know, so it is good in that respect. This was actually one of the reasons that Liz Anderson was a fan of the book, is because her new book, and I don't know if you've had her on yet, but you definitely should.
Liz Anderson, we've had her on a few times.
Well, but the new book that she's just finished, she starts off with this idea of like the Puritan theology of work and the way that the great political economist secularizes it in two different directions. And so she's actually been doing a lot of reading theology and thinking through particularly the Protestant theology of work. It's like Change How I See Locke, for instance, like the idea that he has a theology of work that's really important. It helps you see the Second Treatise in a kind of a whole new light. And so I actually, you know, exchanged manuscripts, and we're both entirely convinced that, like, you cannot fully make the case for liberalism or even really social democracy, the full case, unless you kind of understand some of the theological currents and influences. And so I would just say it's a good thing for liberals to at least spend a little bit of time with to try to understand what's going on, because I think, as we saw with the New Atheism, it did collapse. And I think partly because it wasn't really getting at what's going on in religious belief.
It was an aggressively uninformed critique. Like, I think that's fair to say, you know?
No, that's right. That's right.
And, well, at some point, perhaps we will have to do a conversation on the interface between Christianity and liberalism, because I think...
My next project, so for sure.
At some point, let's do that, because I have stuff to say on that, and we can maybe get into it then. But let's close that, because if we start on that, that will just be another
hour and a half. Yes, that's right.
There. The book is All the Kingdoms of the World on Radical Religious Alternatives to Liberalism, which is now available again from Amazon. Anywhere else you'd like to direct listeners or say in closing?
If they go to my website, kevinvalier.com, and they can click through to, say, Oxford's page, there's a discount code, so they can get the book for hardback for $21. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's pretty cheap for a book like this, so I had to have that throw that out. I blog on these issues a little bit at my Substack, The Liberal Tortoise, which is pretty new. But also, you can follow me at Twitter to see a lot of this stuff. So it's at kvalier, K-V-A-L-L-I-E-R. And I think we have some fun, you and I do, and there's a lot of liberals who follow along, but also a lot of integralists, and so I think there's some kind of weird stuff going on that makes it of interest. And also, just broadly, I really like to talk to people about political philosophy. So, you know, if you have questions, you know, just like email me or whatever, I'll respond. So,
cool. Thanks for coming back on again, man. I really appreciate it.
No, it was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.